SO229. I have the female that was on the passenger seat separated from the male. Keys are on the hood. You want to tell me what's going on?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, some days, I have really bad OCD. And I was just cleaning and straightening up the back of the van before, and I was apologizing to him and saying, I'm sorry that I'm so mean, because sometimes I have OCD and sometimes I just get really frustrated. Not like mean towards him, I just like, I guess my vibe is like, I'm really like in a bad mood. And I was just saying, I'm sorry if I'm in a bad mood, I've just been really stressed. I had so much work I was doing on my computer this morning.
What do you do for a living?
I think it's for getting an organic juice bar, but I just quit my job.
Okay.
I was a nutritionist.
That's
my job. And I just quit my job to travel across the country, and I'm trying to start a blog. And have a blog and stuff. So I've been building my website, so I've just been really stressed, and he doesn't really believe that I could do any of it, so that's kind of been like a, he's like a downer. I don't know, we've just been fighting all morning, and he wouldn't let me in the car before. And
why wouldn't he let you in the car? Because of your OCD?
He told me I needed to calm down, yeah. But I'm perfectly calm. I'm calm all the time, and he really stresses me out, and this is a rough morning.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't I sit you down in the back seat of my car? You're not in any trouble, okay? I'm not going to be putting handcuffs on you. You obviously don't have any weapons. I'm going to get you into the air conditioning, let you take a breath, relax a little bit, and then I'll come back and talk to you in a few minutes, okay?
Okay.
All righty. This is what I'm going to do. I've decided I am not going to cite you for domestic violence battery, okay? It was only going to be a Class B misdemeanor. However, the domestic violence portion of it enhances it, makes life a major pain in the butt, especially at your 22, right? So I'm choosing not to cite you today. So you are not going to be charged with it. All right? But this is what I do have to do. I am separating the two of you tonight. Okay? I want you guys both to be tonight away from each other, relax, breathe, cry, because there's no reason to be crying now, okay? I understand that this can feel like it's a nightmare, but you're coming out as the golden flower on top of it, okay? So, you're gonna be taking the van tonight. And you're going to go somewhere else. I am going to get him lined up for the hotel room tonight. I want you guys to stay away from each other. For both of you guys the same. From what you told me and what he told me, you guys have a bunch of little things that are building up, building up, building up. And finally, the little string that you guys were tight walking on broke tonight. Does that sound about right? So, I just want everybody to breathe, get a chance away from each other. Go eat a meal, talk to your parents, whatever it is you gotta do.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of Crime Analyst and new mama to little baby Rafi. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and executive producer of Fox's new America's Most Wanted.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm a casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. We're so happy to have Mamacita with us today, but it is such a sad day. We're talking about a case that our listeners are just so wrapped up in, of course, the disappearance and now death of Gabrielle Petito. And I just couldn't wait to talk to you both about so many things about this case.
Yeah, it's very concerning.
Yeah.
Been watching it unfold, I think probably like most people have. And lots of people have asked me my point of view on it, particularly when she was missing. And in terms of law enforcement interaction of just what's been going on and why weren't mom and dad of Brian laundry spoken to and potentially arrested. And I think there's lots of people with just so many questions about what's happening. But first of all, I just want to say my heart really does go out to Gabby's family and friends and people around her. It's just such a, you know, horrific thing. I'm not going to use the word tragedy because these aren't tragedies. And
it's a terrible crime.
Preventable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and speaking of that, I mean, I think today I would really like to start right off with the police body cam video. Yeah. I saw it and I was immediately struck by the first officer. We'll call him first cop. And
Officer Robbins. Yeah, he was the first responder.
And then the second officer was the big cop. I don't know his name, but I'll just call him the big cop. But I thought that the first officer, first of all, his demeanor was exceptional and his reaction to seeing Gabby in distress and separating her and making sure she was safe and felt like she can talk about what happened. That all started off great. But then cop number two came in. And I don't know what you think about this, Laura, but I think two things happened. Misogyny kicked in and that second cop superimposed his ex-wife's behavior onto this case and decided that the woman in this case has to be the aggressor and that Brian was the victim. And so they turned at that point, he was able to convince the other officer and turned the whole thing around on Gabby. Did you get the same thing? I mean, I felt like there were so many indicators of coercive control in Brian and in the behavior and what Gabby said to the cops that they never followed up on.
Yes. I mean, firstly, you know, with every case, there are opportunities to intervene and ask questions and ask the right questions. And I think what we're seeing on the body cam is an hour and 17 minutes, where in my opinion, the right questions actually weren't asked of the right person. And just if you look at time distribution, you see most of the time is spent with Brian and not with Gabby, with three male officers. And that troubled me greatly. I think this particular body cam, let's put it into context, it was less than a month before her family reported her missing. So it's not right on the window of time. Well, we don't know when she goes missing, of course, but there was some criticism. I did see law enforcement, a police officer, criticise the family for taking time to report her missing. And I do just want to say that, well, the family didn't know whether she was missing or not. They hadn't had contact with her. And I don't want to see or hear victim blame about what somebody did or didn't do, particularly in the early stages of an investigation. But the police at that time, the officer who criticised the family, said that there wasn't a crime. So again, having an open mind and questioning things, that when a young girl just disappears and her family are saying, well, it's been 17 days, we would normally check in with her. We haven't heard from her. We are now very concerned. And it's the later stages of her being missing. Then you would expect there to be critical questioning of Brian Laundrie's family, because Gabby had been living with them for a year beforehand. And I think that's very important,
right,
that she had lived with them. So there was a connection there in terms of how the Laundrie's, their interaction with Gabby. And they would most likely know she wasn't someone who would just go missing. But I think, you know, first of all, the fact that the van's pulled over, it's pulled over by the police because of reckless driving. And quite often I see with cases, a perpetrator or an abuser use reckless driving to scare a victim. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened here, but it's really important all police officers are trained, whether they're traffic police officers, whoever they might be, because you will come across victims in every place and every space. And that's a clear opportunity to ask the right questions. And I agree, Jim, the first officer did do the right things, separating them as soon as he saw Gabby was distressed. And we have to remember she was crying first. She was the one that was visibly distressed. He was very calm.
Yes.
Calm and apologetic and
charming.
Hey, sorry. So
many
weird
apologies. Yeah, multiple apologies of trying to de-escalate and diffuse
and you know, minimize.
Bro chat in between as well, of the joking, the laughter that went on. But I thought Gabby's opener was very interesting. I'm struggling with my mental health, OCD. She takes responsibility for everything.
Right.
And
she blames herself, he blames her. Right.
Yeah. So he doesn't take responsibility at all for anything, but she does take responsibility for everything. And the minute you police officers, and this is just my experience across 25 years, the minute they hear something to do with mental health, instantly, unfortunately, victims, particularly women, are stigmatized, that there's something that is at fault with them. There's something that's wrong with them. And therefore the male is just reacting to what's going on. So I think, unfortunately, they fell into possibly not the first officer, as you said, Jim, because later on we do hear him questioning the other officers. She is the primary aggressor conclusion, and he does question that. But everything about this body cam footage screams desperate, urgent need for training.
Right.
Three male officers who clearly are out of their depth. And even the language, the incident appeared to be more of a mental and emotional break than a domestic incident.
Right.
So incident, there's no such thing. This is patterned behavior. But the minute they put it into emotional mental break, they're not seeing it for what it is. And therefore, the right questions are not being asked of Gabby. And I think she is the one that is so distressed. Her demeanor, everything about her behavior is submissive. I believe she has taken on language that she has acquired.
Exactly.
Through
she
him.
Adopted it. Mm-hmm. Right. And,
yeah.
and there's
and she
clues
says,
in
he
there.
Didn't support my business. He doesn't believe in
he
me.
He doesn't believe I can do it. And she says a whole bunch of things. I was apologizing to him, saying I'm sorry that I'm so mean. Not really, just my vibe isn't just I'll be in a bad mood. I've been trying to start a vlog. I've been really stressed. He doesn't really believe that I can do any of it. So that's kind of been a downer. We've just been fighting all morning. And then she said, and he wouldn't let me in the car before. I mean, that's the punishment, right? She didn't live up to his rules. And so he wouldn't let her in the car. And so what if he wants to go for a walk? Fine. Because he claims, oh, I told her to go walk that way and I'll walk this way and we'll just calm down. But I didn't want her to go anywhere. Well, what does that tell you? He's controlling her. He's limiting her movement. Like all these little signs, of course, of control that you've been talking about for years, Laura, are right here. They did have a female officer come up later and she was talking to Gabby, but they never asked the female officer what she had learned. They never used that in the calculations of what they were going to do or their determination. The second cop was very, very carefully twisting everything into a format so that it could be Brian was the victim. And what happened was that, like, for example, Brian immediately said, oh, the reason why he hit the curb was because she yanked the wheel. She grabbed the wheel and yanked it. When the first officer actually asked her specifically and repeatedly, she was adamant in her denial. She said, no, I never grabbed the wheel. I never touched the wheel. I hit his arm, but I never touched the wheel. So when the bigger cop said, well, you know, if somebody's hitting my arm, I'm gonna do this, right? So that makes sense. So he's spinning it. He's trying to make it sound like, oh, well, what Brian said, the lie he told us, the direct, deliberate lie, blaming her for something, that's okay because, yeah, I could see that happening. And, you know, and then even when he's talking, when he finally does talk to Gabby, the larger officer, he says, yeah, you know, well, my ex-wife, and this is why she's my ex, you know, she went through a lot of anxiety too, and we fed upon each other's anxiety. And, well, he's already superimposing that on this situation. And clearly he's got a bias against that situation, against the woman in that situation, his ex-wife, and he's superimposing that on Gabby. What would have been different had instead of them giving him a hotel room, had they put her in a shelter where she could talk to somebody, where she could be interviewed by somebody who understands coercive control and domestic violence? It's clear that these two officers have been schooled in how to handle a domestic violence situation. They're saying all the buzzwords. They know they must arrest if there's been violence and so forth. But what they haven't been schooled in is the subtleties and the incredible importance of not leading the witnesses, you know, of not saying how he asked the questions of her and making sure that his reading of the scenario is supported. And he says, I called the witness and the witness said, yeah, they saw him shove her, but they didn't know what she might have done before that. So he automatically assumes that she did something to him before that. And he uses that to convince the first officer that she was the aggressor. She says, he grabbed me here, right? He grabbed me here. Twice she said that. And that's where I got this cut. I can feel it on the side of my face.
But this and is where the dash is very important because the domestic abuse risk model,
right.
It really helps guide people. You know, you can't be an expert in everything, but it does help structure the questions that you should really be asking. And I think that's absolutely clear here that they're out of their depth.
Yeah.
And I think the focus on physical is really significant. And of course, we know that most of the time, law enforcement training tends to focus on physical violence and not coercive control and psychological and emotional. But one of the officers just kept saying, well, did he hit you? And then kept putting his own words into her mouth. And I just want to talk a minute just about how scary that situation might be for a young female who's 22 years of age. And you've got three male officers who are quite big officers. And if you've had no contact with law enforcement, this is quite a scary situation too. So even if you are being abused and you know you are, you most likely don't want to get your partner into trouble. And
well, especially if you're going to, you're going to get punished for it.
Yeah, yeah, you're stuck with him anyway. You're trapped with him for the duration.
Exactly. And I'm not sure she does understand the control issues, but I would have liked to have heard questions about the anxiety. Why did she have so much anxiety? That would have been one of my first questions. What makes you anxious? Because everything is about him then managing her anxiety and that it's a reaction and he's the good one trying to deal with this sort of emotional, hysterical young woman who has mental health issues. And that's sort of how it's seen. And I think that that is not just unfortunate. It just shows why the dash is so important. It shows why training is so important. It shows why in the UK we have specialist advocates who ride with the police officers who would go out and ask these questions. And I think that it shows here that we really need that in America. They should have referred to a specialist agency who could have asked the right questions. But she was clear. She stayed true to what had happened in her account, and she offered up everything, putting herself more as the person to be seen as responsible. And he was just so calm. And I think you see that relief from him once they decide that she is the primary aggressor, the way, her demeanor, everything about her screams the opposite.
I know she says
if they understood nuance detail and the nuance detail, the context of everything that's going on is what they missed in the whole totality. And just bear in mind, 1 hour 17 is a long time. The dash could have been asked in a very short amount of time. But when they say that she is the aggressor, you hear Brian laugh. I think he doesn't quite believe his own version of events. And so he's kind of relieved that they believe what he's saying. He's laughing and joking about it because he's seen as the victim.
And since then, there's been the revelation that there was a 911 call in which the caller said that they see him slapping her in the street repeatedly. And that is the call that came in. This is what he describes as, well, I just pushed her away and I got a little loud and that was that. But
he
also
said it was a little disagreement. And again, the words
minimizing
are really important, language.
And he says, when asked specifically about how he got the cut over his eyes, he said that was her phone. Oh, and the keys. But he also said earlier that she had been trying to take the keys away from him. But he had the keys and he shoved her away. So she didn't have the keys. And then later he says, well, her rings and the keys.
Her nails and her rings.
Right. Yeah. And he's repeating that's what's happening. But clearly this was some time that had elapsed. It didn't just happen. He has a cut over his eye. He has scratches on his face. He has scratches on his neck. He has scratches on his arms. He has scratches on his hand. This didn't happen in 2 seconds. And they just joked about, oh yeah, his nails and all this stuff. They were having that little bro moment like that you were talking about. But clearly he was lying right from the start about her yanking the wheel. He was minimizing his behavior, blaming everything on her while she was taking the blame and apologizing and saying, I always apologize to him. He tells me I have to calm down, but I'm perfectly calm. He really stresses me out. This has been a really rough morning. I just saw so many of the things that you talk about all the time, Laura, where women victims or any victims of coercive control, really adopt the language of the offender and take on the burden of the blame for not following rules, for not doing things right. It's just a very difficult thing to see when you know this could have been an intervention point that could have actually possibly saved her life.
Hey, it's Brian coming to you from Los Angeles, California. On the next Killer Casting podcast, Lisa, Dean, and I talk about the best things we're watching on Hulu and beyond. There's so much content out there on so many platforms. We sit down to curate what you should be watching and why you should be watching it. From a dark mystery about a world with no men to one of the best, most irreverent animated series on television. Join us on Killer Casting Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your pods.
Like the cops got very distracted by the fact that they didn't want to arrest her. And they're going round and round trying to figure out how they can get out of charging it. And they're talking, but they're ignoring her in a way. They've like you've said, they've made the assessment that, you know, on paper, she's the aggressor. You know, they're kind of bound by what they think the law is because Brian has all the scratches, and they're just going round and round on how to, should they take her to jail? Shouldn't they, should they get him, you know, and they don't deal with her at all. And I just keep thinking she's not calming down, right? She's mm-hmm. got water. She's in AC. It's not blowing over. There's something deeper going on. And it's so frustrating to watch.
It is. And I think here, although you do have one officer who tries to be empathetic, he puts her in the aircon, etc. He tries to do the right thing, but none of them really understand what's going on because they're not spending enough time talking with her. And I think that the interaction of all three of them keep dipping into each of their narratives rather than having one officer being consistent
right.
is also a problem because you're re-traumatizing people if you keep asking them to repeat what's going on, unless it's the same officer asking for clarification of points. But it's clear that they just accept his version of events. And when you have inconsistent accounts, you have to probe more. And yes, you may have a witness who sees a part of what's gone on, but you don't know the whole context of everything that's happening. And perhaps if Brian really wanted her to calm down, well, why don't you sit in the van, you be in the aircon? I've got to go for a walk. I need to clear my
right,
head.
But he locked
you
her out.
You wouldn't expect him to leave her out and to add to her anxiety of locking her out. So everything about his language is blaming her, is seeing her as the problem. But he does say, I love her, and so on later on.
Right.
But at that point, he's now relieved because the officers see him as the victim. So taking him off and getting him, and I think one of the officers said, the male is going to be our victim, which was a really odd turn of phrase. Is going to be our victim. Like, we've now decided that this guy is going to be our victim. We normally
it
have female victims.
They've cast the role of
like
the victim.
Well, it didn't feel authentic at all in the way that they interacted with him. And the laughing and the joking, I just found really concerning. That bro culture, which most people don't realize that's what's going on, but it is. My wife's the same. I got her on meds. Once she's on her meds, she's okay. You know, these women, they're a
right,
bit cuckoo.
Exactly, exactly.
That's the subtext of what's going on.
And that big cop, he said to Gabby, you tend to have a lot of anxiety and stress. Is Brian pretty patient with you about that? And she says, yes, but I know that he gets frustrated with me a lot. They never followed up on that. What do you mean that he gets frustrated? What does he do when he's frustrated? Did he do that today? What did he do today? That they didn't follow up. All he was trying to do was get her to admit that she gets frustrated a lot, that she has problems. And then he went on and he talks about his ex-wife. And this superimposing here, I think, caused him and caused the other officer to make a really, well, what could be deadly decision about what was going on here. And they literally had an opportunity. The reason why in domestic violence cases, they must arrest the aggressor is because we all know, because of thousands and thousands and thousands of these cases, that if you let it be unaddressed, if you let them stay in that situation, even if the person who has been hurt wants the other one to stay, that it can be deadly for that other person. It can be deadly for the person who's actually the target of the violence. And in this case, we don't know yet, but it very well could be that that's exactly what happened here.
The problem with a positive arrest strategy is that, do you have the right victim? Do you know who the true victim is? And we see this a lot, unfortunately, where decisions are made and roles are cast. And particularly, you know, some officers want to see more male victims, and they will push the envelope to ensure that the female is seen as the aggressor. You know, there's nothing in her behavior or her demeanor that says that. Even in terms of the injuries, yes, you have to take things seriously, but they still haven't established a full context of what went on. They have one witness who's given them a snippet of what happened. The bruise on the arm is questionable to me. How does a bruise happen so quickly? If that was in the van and that's what caused the swerve, the bruise wouldn't come up for a couple of days. I train police officers on that. You have to wait for a bruise to come up. Just because a victim doesn't have strangulation marks around the neck, it doesn't mean to say they weren't strangled. So again, that was questionable to me, just how he reacted. Brian, I just think that he believes he's very lucky that he's got these officers who now are going to waive the speeding, waive the reckless driving. They're now not seeing him because he said, oh, I hope she hasn't said, made too many complaints about me.
Right.
He is nervous about what she's going to say. And that's another indicator. He wants to know what she's saying. And
yeah, when it first
comes
back,
we don't know whether she's asking those questions because we don't see as much of her. We don't see dialogue that she's having with other people. And even if they did bring a female officer in later on, they've already made up their minds. That's clear. Other than the first officer. And again, I don't know what the ranks are, Jim, but if the bearded officer, the bigger guy, was the supervisor, then it's every chance that the less experienced officer will follow their lead.
Right.
Even if they suspect there's a different narrative going on. And that, again, is where I like to empower officers. Even if your supervisor is saying something else, if you have interviewed the victim, if you see it as a high-risk situation, you must follow that. Because if your supervisor wasn't there or they haven't asked the right questions, they haven't been trained on domestic abuse, what I'm seeing from those officers is they're literally going through the textbook.
Right.
This is what we should do without any discretion, without any real common sense, because they want it to fit a certain way. But she's clearly not a threat. She's clearly not aggressive. Her demeanor is diminutive. She's subservient. She acquiesces. She's admitting everything. She's clearly an open book. But the anxiety, I really wanted to know more about that, of what's causing it. Because they were 4 or 5 months on the road?
Yeah.
Just together in this bubble. And her saying that he doesn't believe in what she's doing. And he says she's got this little website, little blog. Everything about his language is really undermining.
But did you see when the first officer came back after separating Gabby, the first thing, as he's there, as he arrives, Brian asks him, you talk to Gabby, my fiance, right? You talk to her. And he's very anxious, very anxious. And I believe he's very worried about what she actually told him. And when the officer is polite and says, could you step out? And they're all talking like guys and everything's good. It's an interview strategy. And I think it's very effective. But you could see like the anxiety level on him go way down. Now he's calm. He's charming. He's joking. He's laughing. He's blaming it on flies. And he said something. Hold on a second. What did he say? Crisscross applesauce. When he was sitting on the curb, they asked him, you know, would you sit on the curb? And he says, I'll say crisscross applesauce. Can I sit in the shade because I'm bald? But anyway,
I mean, he's clearly very nervous. And it's probably just part of that, Jim, because, you know, he is so apologetic. The amount of apologies that he's trying to get this situation to go away because he doesn't want probably extra questions being asked. So it's probably a nervous disposition, like his laughter and his agitation that's being hidden in a way that he's kind of joking around. And when you said it's an interview strategy for the three of them to be talking to him, I didn't feel it was. I actually felt it was just part of them the guys just being guys with him, that they see him as the victim. Everything's relaxed at that point, other than they have to problem solve that they don't want to send her to jail. I mean, why would you send her to jail? It's such a ridiculous thing if they'd asked the right questions. And she's clearly not a threat. And I don't believe that, I mean, I'd have to see what Moab City Police Department's policy is, but I can't believe that they arrest absolutely everyone for every call out that they receive. And perhaps right. Someone would tell me that they do, but I've never seen an area or a country who even has a mandated positive arrest policy not use discretion in some cases, because there are always cases where you do have to problem solve them. And if you bring in an expert, you have a specialist who can help you understand what's going on. Unfortunately, majority of women who are arrested do tend to be the victims. And that's exactly why you do need to have specialist training. And if you are an officer and you haven't had specialist training, well, ensure that you refer at the very least to a domestic violence organization, because I have it on good authority. There was one literally 5 minutes down the road from where they were. And so even though they're from out of town, they still should have been ripping off as part of their police report a little card to give to her, potentially to him too, and actually signposting them there and having a specialist actually talk to both of them. I would never have let her go, particularly if she was still crying at the end.
Yeah.
She was still distressed. As you said, Lisa, she wasn't calmed down by any of it. And there clearly were more things that they should have been asking about of her relating to her anxiety.
I kept waiting for that cop, the first cop who it sounds like I'm defending. I don't know, but I kept waiting for him to say, if you need to call me, here's my number, you know, once you're away right. from here, to give her some kind of lifeline. And then what did you guys think about that cop basically giving her this weird get out of jail free text to say, like, were you attempting to harm him and give him physical pain? Be careful what you say. Like, this is the right. weirdest exchange.
Well, I just think they realized the administrative nightmare that they were opening up, and they realized that if they characterized it as a non-violent or domestic violence situation, that it could be forgotten and they could use their discretion. I don't know what the tipping point was for them for that, but it could be that Officer One said, I don't want to arrest her. And Officer Two said, all right, well, then we're going to have to do this. And he sets it up. But you know, it's very clear in this body cam footage that, like, they were, as you said earlier, they were going, quote, by the book. But at the same time, they were missing these glaring warning signs and red flags all over the place. The lies on the part of Brian, the blaming her on the part of Brian, the taking self-blame on the part of Gabby, the fact that she says over and over again, he doesn't like it when I do this, or he gets upset at me at times, you know, I always disappoint him, you know, all these things. He doesn't believe I can do this. This is all very, very clear indicators that he is controlling her and that she is most likely the victim here. And unfortunately, they just didn't see it.
I'm interested in your view, Jim. I mean, he returns without her. So they go as two, they're engaged. They've got their future ahead of them. They've been staying with his parents. They return and she's nowhere in sight.
Right.
And obviously he spends time with his parents. But then when Gabby's family do call the police, when they realize that there's something going on, and they have pleaded with Brian's family, they have written and they have said, please tell us, you know her, she lived with you. You can imagine if this was your child, please tell us where Brian last saw her or left her. And they got nowhere with that, which again right. is huge red flags, isn't it?
It is.
But then the police are called, but they don't cooperate. Brian obviously disappears himself. And I'm not going to say missing, because he clearly has taken himself off. But I think the first point of interaction when the police are called, that they don't tend, well, from what I can tell, they haven't probed, and the FBI are called in, but there seems to be no real investigation because they, what one of the officers says on camera is that no crime has been committed. What's your view on that?
Well, there's a few things you mentioned there. So when he comes back and Gabby's not with him, obviously it raised questions with his family. Obviously they understood something was amiss here. I don't know what he told them, but at that point, it seems like they started covering for him. They apparently got him a lawyer up in Long Island, and his lawyer is basically saying he's not going to talk because the police are going to twist everything he says. There is a major difference between invoking your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination when you're being questioned in a police setting or in a court setting. And that's a right everybody has, and I get it. But when that's being weighed against the life of a person who's out there, when somebody's life is at risk and you decide, well, I don't want to risk the police twisting what I have to say, so I'm not going to say anything. He could have told his parents what happened and they could have conveyed it. He could have told his lawyer what happened and they could have conveyed it, and he could have been insulated. He didn't do any of that. And so, as I said the other night, I thought it didn't bode very well for his participation in her disappearance or for her current status. I didn't think either of those things were going to turn out to be good because of how he acted, not just because he invoked and he got a lawyer. That's normal. But getting a lawyer and not conveying critical information about where she was last seen or why she wasn't with him and what exactly happened through the lawyer or through his family, that tells me it was bigger than a red flag. This was like, oh my God, this can't be good for Gabby. This can't be good at all.
Yes. I mean, I said similarly, I was talking to a domestic violence advocate who had asked me my opinion, and I said I didn't think it was going to end well. And then the news came on that a body has been found. And I don't know if it's being confirmed as yet, but I think it's in terms 100%. Of the fact that he didn't report her missing, when he's not saying anything at all other than, well, the police, I know what happens in these sorts of cases, I think was what he said, and it's normally the intimate partner that's looked at. Well, given the history, given the fact that Moab City Police Department were called, there was an interaction. These are just huge red flags, and his mum and dad not cooperating with police either. I probably would have been advising around obstruction at that point, because we've got time and distance, and they did spend time with him. And we don't know whether he did tell them, but mums always tend to know what's going on. They have an instinct, and there does seem to have been, you know, we have to wait for the full police investigation to find out what's gone on. But it does seem that the house has now been sealed as a crime scene.
Right.
I mean, it might be because she lived there for a year beforehand, but they must have a very good understanding of her and who she was and just her behavior and her demeanor,
you,
that she wasn't just going to take herself off in the middle of nowhere.
Right. And why
she's
wouldn't
building
you,
a business.
As her future parents-in-law, why wouldn't you immediately report it to the police? Why would you not report that your son went missing days earlier? Why would you go and get his car and not tell people about it? You know, all those things tell me that they were only concerned about him and not concerned about her. And that could be because they already knew she was dead. I don't know. But clearly they processed the van. So if there's any blood, hair, fibers that are relevant, then that they probably already collected that. They probably are processing the same thing in the house and taking all the electronic equipment, as well as all the phones and the GPSs from the cars and any kind of communications and credit card records and receipts, hopefully. In one of the other cars, they'll find that the car went a certain place, and that's where Brian will be found. I don't know. I don't know what they've gotten so far, but it's just, to me, again, such a tragedy that the opportunity to intervene was missed because at least this one officer had made up his mind very early on, without asking critical questions of Gabby, that Gabby was the aggressor and Brian was the victim. It's just, and I will say, I don't know if you were ticking off things in the antisocial behavior column or the psychopathy column that he, Brian, you know, the quick recovery, the glib charm, the joking, you know, all this kind of stuff, the lying, you know, these are all on the psychopathy checklist. And I thought, you know, this guy could be really dangerous.
Yes, and certainly him diminishing her. I just kept hearing all the way through, rather than her being equal partner to him and or greater than, I heard him say, I love her, but he diminished her the whole way through. And it's those kinds of tells that people should really be listening out for. So we know that lots of people are not trained, and I'm saying people, professionals across all industries, as well as families, don't always know what to look for. But keeping when people keep asking about physical injury, you're missing all the coercive and controlling related behaviors, the psychological, the emotional, that kind of level of anxiety I see in lots of victims who've suffered from coercive control. And I'm not calling it post-traumatic stress disorder, because a lot of people, it's not post, it's still going on. So I would imagine that the body cam footage was quite triggering for a lot of people. Those who've experienced coercive control know her behavior is all about the walking on eggshells, the demeanor, the everything she says is about his view of her, you know, that I'm mean. And it's
OCD,
it's about how,
OCD.
Yeah, how important he sees her in terms of her worldview, that he doesn't support her, doesn't think she'll be able to do this business, that everything is just undervaluing and diminishing. And therefore, we may not see certain things that people expect with coercive control, but these tells are there, the nuance. And training is just so important. And I will just say that there's lots of domestic violence specialist services out there, but actually, Jim, not all of them are trained in coercive control. And I will say that running law reform campaigns, I have a lot of resistance from some domestic violence services who are anti-coercive control being criminalized. But this case really does show yet again why it's so important that people understand that it correlates significantly with serious harm and femicide. It's not men being killed, it's femicide. And therefore, we don't know everything that happened in between. We don't know when she actually went missing, because Brian hasn't said, and he's certainly no longer around to give a version of events. But it wouldn't surprise me that this has been going on for a long time. And family members may well not have even picked up themselves the nuanced detail of control-related behaviors. So I don't expect everyone to be an expert on it, but the more we raise awareness about those behaviors, and on my website, I have lots of different tabs about coercive control. Because even when people use it, they use coercive control and domestic abuse interchangeably, and it's not one and the same thing. You can have someone who's abused, but they're not being entrapped and coercively controlled and dominated in every way that we tend to see perpetrators who are coercively controlling use. And psychological and emotional abuse tends to be a subset of behaviors of coercive control. They're not one and the same either. So you're really looking for entrapment and male entitlement, which I saw, even in hearing her language, he wouldn't let me in the van. A lot of things are about permissive behavior of what he would allow. So they're the things to be looking out for, and the undoing of self. You know, you look at everything in behavior, and I have to say both of them seemed real thin. They both seemed very thin. And she said she was a nutritionist. To me, she looked malnourished and
dehydrated.
And I don't know whether what her baseline is, but certainly her fragility came through to me. And I'm not talking about vulnerability. I'm talking about some, you know, fragility in terms of how much she hangs everything on him. So again, it's looking for things like fragility and vulnerability, and that taking into account everything about a situation. It's not just asking questions. It's about how someone's demeanor is. How are they when they're interacting? You know, if they're looking down, if they're present, but they're not present. They're clearly thinking about other things. And to me, yes, she was distracted. Yes, she was emotional. But there was just so many more opportunities where they could have asked a different set of questions about what was happening. And I just see a young woman who clearly has self-esteem issues, confidence issues, and a young man who is very strident, who is looking to manipulate and to have his narrative and version of events believed. And of course, that's what happened. And that can reinforce someone to take it to the next level. when they're reinforced by other people.
I was going to ask you that he learned that, you know, he got a pass this time. He didn't even get a fucking ticket for speeding, for going 40 in a 15 mile an hour, you know, anyway.
Well, he was treated well, wasn't he? Don't worry, we'll help you. We're sorted out. We'll get you into a, you know, somewhere to stay. Oh, we need to work out how you get to the police station if you want to go the next morning. The male is going to be our victim. That phrase to me just stood out. But yes, really concerning. And I'm glad, you know, in a way we had an opportunity to discuss it, because I think lots of people are genuinely baffled as to what's gone on. And I am hearing lots of people mentioning coercive control now, which wouldn't have happened some time ago. But I desperately want these officers, those officers in particular, and all law enforcement to be trained by experts in coercive control to spot these nuanced signs. It's the subtext of what's going on. It's not the act itself. It's understanding the behavioral tells. And actually, once you're trained, it's really easy to pick up and understand, but it's the investment in training, Lisa. It's somebody saying as a leader, this is important and we need to do it, because 4 to 5 women are killed a day by a male partner or ex-partner, 4 to 5 women a day in America. So, and in Australia, it's 1 a week. In the UK, it's 1 woman every 3 days killed by a male ex-partner or partner, and 1 woman every 4 days killed by a man in the UK. So male violence is something we have to attend to. And I've been playing my part, changing laws, you know, 8 law changes, still pushing the envelope. We've got the Connecticut law of coercive control now. And I was on Dr. Phil talking about coercive control just recently, and we talked about the California law. And so gradually it's getting into the zeitgeist, but it's training people. I'd love to see a federal law, and there's a lot of work to do. But my heart and soul really does hurt for Gabby's family and friends, and for her and what she endured. It's these cases are preventable. That's the problem for me, can do so much more.
And I hope that there aren't going to be so many more Gabbies for us to finally learn those really important lessons. Okay, well, thank you for jumping on with this. And our hearts go out to the family of Gabrielle. Her name was Gabrielle Petito.
Yes, and please do use the hashtag when you're interacting with us on social media. Hashtag her name was Gabby Petito. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.